Good morning. I intend to take us through the entire book of Esther this morning. But that passage from chapter 4 is central to what I want to bring. So if you'd like, please do feel free to follow along. In the book of Esther, I'll be reading from the New Revised Standard Version, which I think is the same as that in the Pew Bibles. And I'll read three passages, a long passage of 9 verses from chapter 1, a shorter passage from chapter 2, and then that same passage that we just read moments ago from chapter 4. I planned this morning to speak about privilege. And in thinking about what that word privilege is, I realized that there are actually a lot of ways of talking about it, a lot of ways in which that word gets used. We tend to think of privilege as a kind of power dynamic that affects our ability to relate to one another, especially socioculturally. For instance, there are things that I have access to, or freedom to, or visibility for, or the ability to, and someone else doesn't have those same things, and so then I would recognize that that means I have privilege. There's some other ways of thinking about privilege, though, and I came up with three this morning that I hope will be helpful for us in looking at how the book of Esther presents the problem of privilege. One, I'm exempt from the oppression that my neighbor experiences. Two, I'm complicit in the oppression that my neighbor experiences. Three, I benefit from the oppression that my neighbor experiences. I want to say, no, that's not true. But I know that in relationships where there's a differential of power, even in a parent-child relationship or in a relationship between friends of different genders, that all these things can be true in spite of my best intentions. And sometimes these things become true because of decisions that I make or because of a change in our cultural context. What allows privilege to flourish in ways that are bad for other people is I see myself as different, which is a very short step away from thinking of myself as better than the person that I'm in a relationship with. And this dynamic is played out in human relationships across cultures, across time. It's universal and pervasive. It just is. So the question is, what do we do about it? And I picked the book of Esther because the book of Esther provides a relatively complex study, more so than just about any other short section of scripture that I could think of, in illustrating what privilege does and how we might undo it. If there are systems of oppression that are affecting my neighbor, how do we change that? How do we undo those? How do we rebuild or build from scratch a completely different kind of world, a completely different kind of existence, a completely different kind of kingdom? How do we seek an answer to the prayer, Lord, your kingdom come, on earth as it is in heaven? Esther happens to be a book of the Bible in which the name of God is not mentioned, and so some might say that makes the book of Esther suspect. In fact, there's just one verse in chapter 4 that tends to show up in sermons, and the rest of the book doesn't show up that much at all unless it's being used as an illustration for that one verse for this time and for this place. So why is it in the Bible? I want to suggest that God is actually in the story, that God shows up in the story in some ways that we miss because God is not explicitly named. And I want to show those to you because what the story does in leaving out the explicit name of God is it forces us to look at the human dynamics, the very real nature of our relationships to one another and to the other. And through these dynamics, the book of Esther questions the reality that we live in, the reality that we think of our privilege or don't think of it. It's really easy for me to deny, because of the complexity of privilege and how it works, that it doesn't exist, that it's not real. And Esther says, well, look at this. Consider this. What about this? So there are four characters in Esther that I am going to have us look at as I'm reading through the text. Queen Vashti is the first in chapter 1, Mordecai and Esther in chapters 2 and 4, especially in chapter 4. And then also the eunuchs. There are 12 eunuchs in the book of Esther, and they are relatively invisible, although several of them are named. But each of the eunuchs functions to move the story. Every time that there is a change of scene or a change of direction or a stop and then a start again, there's usually a eunuch there playing a role in making that part of the story function or making that part of the action function. And these eunuchs don't have privilege. They are invisible to us. I don't even know how to pronounce their names. Hegai and Hatak are the two that will show up in the scriptures that I read. And I think it's important for us to notice these quote-unquote invisible characters. So let's go ahead and start with chapter 1, verses 1 through 9. This happened in the days of Ahasuerus, the same Ahasuerus who ruled over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. So we're reading the story of an empire. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in the citadel of Susa, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of his officials and ministers. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were present while he displayed the great wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and pomp of his majesty for many days. 180 days in all. That's a party. I'm just imagining how they got food there, let alone the rest of the decorations, and we get a sense of the decorations a little bit further on there. Verse 5. When these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in the citadel of Susa, both great and small, a banquet lasting for 7 days, a banquet to follow the banquet in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and blue hangings tied with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of ored stones. Drinks were served in golden goblets, goblets of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. Drinking was by flagons without restraint, for the king had given orders to all the officials of his palace to do as each one desired. Furthermore, Queen Vashti gave a banquet for the women in the palace of King Ahasuerus. This is the introduction to the story. A great empire, an incredibly wealthy empire, an empire including 127 provinces all the way from India to Ethiopia, one of the greatest empires that we know of in world history, celebrated its might and its wealth in an incredibly visible way. And then to top it all off, did something special for the people at the center of empire. Those who had the most access, the most, as we would say, privilege. And they got drunk, and they were given permission to do just about anything without restraint. In fact, they were required to. They were told to celebrate. It was expected that they would. Who cares what happens, except at the end of the second banquet, the seventh day of the smaller banquet that's happening there at the citadel, a fortress city, a fortress of empire, the capital of this particular empire, the home of the king, the garden of his very palace. And he decides this isn't enough. He needs something more. In order to prove to everyone once and for all how wonderful he is, he needs them to see one part of his property that has been concealed up until this point. He determines that he needs to have the queen come and parade in front of his guests. And this is where the story gets interesting. A good narrative includes conflict. And the conflict here might seem like a small one to us. The queen doesn't think this request is a good idea. Actually, I don't know what she thinks, but I can see from the text that Vashti refuses to come and parade herself in front of the king and his guests. And we can probably imagine the reasons. It might not have been a safe thing for her to do. It may have been publicly demeaning. It might not have felt like love to have someone call on her as if she were property, which she was. So she says no. And the king consults with his sages to try and figure out what to do, and the advice that they give him is that her refusal to come forward is not just a refusal of him personally, but a refusal of everything that his empire stands for. In fact, Vashti's refusal to parade herself in front of the king and his guests is the kind of thing that might cause an end to his empire. Her refusal might inspire others to refuse. That women throughout the land, inspired by Queen Vashti's ability to stand up for herself, might also begin to think of themselves as people, not property. In our own country, we have this history of fear of the other, a fear of revolt, a fear of revolution, a fear of military coup or of government disruption. And we've come up with a lot of strategies throughout our history, some of which are practiced today. Removing somebody's autonomy, taking away their vote, stealing their property, limiting their freedom. There are a lot of ways that empire limits or corrects behavior that looks like it might be disruptive to the empire. And generally, we justify that as a move towards safety. In this case, Vashti too is punished. It appears, although the text doesn't explicitly say, it appears that she is banished. There might be other things that happen to her we don't know, because this is another way that privilege works. Vashti's not central to the story. She's a foil for the privileged character at the center of the story, King Ahasuerus. King Ahasuerus is not actually that interesting, which is another thing that privilege tends to do. It makes us boring. Her purpose or function in the story is to exemplify a problem that the king then has to figure out how to solve, and he does. And then he has another problem, because that's also how stories work. The story is always about him. The story is going to be about his problems, about the resistance that he continues to run up against. And so we move to chapter 2, starting in verse 5. Now there was a Jew in the citadel of Susa, whose name was Mordecai, son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives carried away with King Jeconiah of Judah, whom King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had carried away. Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his cousin, for she had neither father nor mother. The girl was fair and beautiful, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai adopted her as his own daughter. So we have two new others. We had Vashti and Hegai in chapter 1, now Mordecai and Esther. Vashti, a woman, stood up for herself and was banished. Now we have two foreigners whose family had been captured in the conquest of Jerusalem. One is also an orphan. She's been raised by her cousin, who in some translations is sometimes referred to as her uncle. It's a complicated family connection, actually. I think all families are complicated. And apparently, they live in the citadel, so not only are they foreigners in a foreign land, potentially dealing with the difficulties of being othered, how they're seen, how they speak, their traditions, the foods they eat, the part of the city that they probably live in. Often in ancient history, people who were othered and who also find themselves adjacent to power or close to the centers of power are there as servants or as slaves. We don't know very much about Mordecai or about Esther, also called Hadassah in the text, but we do know that they're the only family they have. And Mordecai sees an opportunity. Mordecai is smart, which is what survival teaches the other. They have to be smart in order to survive, and the closer they are to power, the smarter they have to be. He sees an opportunity to improve their situation. Esther is going to have to conceal her heritage, which she's probably already pretty good at doing. She's learned to pass, not necessarily to escape from oppression, but to limit it in order to survive. And the two of them, Esther and Mordecai, make a choice. They take a risk. They're going to try to improve their situation as any human being understandably would want to do, knowing that if they fail, if Esther is not able to pass, this could be the end of their lives, at least as they know it. And having taken this risk, one of the questions the text does not ask, but that we can ask, is how are their own people going to view them? Does this potentially make them traitors? Esther and Mordecai are in a culture that's not their own. They may forever lose the culture that is theirs. The people they have shared heritage with, shared culture with, shared experience with, shared religion with, they take a risk. They could lose it all. Fortunately, at this part of the story, the risk appears to work. The turn comes for each of the girls to go into King Ahasuerus, and when the girl, this is Esther, went into the king, she was given whatever she asked for to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she went in. Then in the morning, she came back. Esther does not have much agency in the story. She gets to choose what risk she will take. She does not get to choose what happens to her as a result of her entering that experience. The story tells us only enough about her to set her up as well as a foil to the king, to the king's story, to the story of empire. Esther's placement in the story is not because of anything special that she's done. Esther's placement in the story is because of her contrast to the king. She's different. Her contrast to what the king cares about, her contrast to what exists for empire. Now, this particular story, the story of Esther, has been passed down to us because something happens in this story that shouldn't happen, that never happens. Esther somehow finds herself in a position where she has more agency than she's had before. It doesn't mean that she's a person of agency or that she's free, because we can tell from reading the story, looking back on the culture, that she's still probably in the position of a slave, even if she doesn't look like a slave to other slaves. She's likely going to be thrown away at some point, the same way that Vashti was. We don't know when, and the story doesn't tell us, because that's not what the story's about. What matters in the story is the disruption of empire that Esther has a very small hand in helping to make happen. But Esther almost chooses not to take that risk. She's already taken an awful lot of risks, maybe too many. She's lost her family, she's lost her people, and she doesn't want to lose her life. I don't blame her. But in chapter 4, we see Mordecai, Esther's cousin, making her life difficult. And even though she's not a person of privilege, her relationship with Mordecai is such that she now has more privilege than Mordecai has. And she resents that he expects her to do something with her privilege that might put her at greater risk than she's already experienced. Don't you know how much I've already taken on? I can just imagine her thinking. So in chapter 4, starting in verse 1, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, and this is a reference to Haman, the villain of the story, preparing to get rid of the Jews. A genocide is in the works in the background of the story, and the story mentions it several times in order to highlight for us how dangerous the position is that both Mordecai and Esther are living in at this point. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went through the city wailing with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. So he intended maybe to go in further, but apparently he was prohibited entry. In every province, wherever the king's command and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and most of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai. Take off that sackcloth. Put on regular clothes, please. So that he might take off that sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, who'd been appointed to attend to her, in order for him to go to Mordecai to learn what was happening and why. Privilege has made Esther a little bit dumb about her people's experience. It's removed her enough from day-to-day persecution, the day-to-day persecution that she used to live with on a day-to-day basis, that she's no longer in touch with what's actually happening. She has to ask. Fortunately, she knows to ask. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther, explain it to her, and charge her to go to the king to make supplication to him and entreat him for her people. Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a message from Mordecai, saying, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called there, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death. Only if the king holds out the golden scepter to someone may that person live. I myself have not been called to come into the king for 30 days. Esther is trying to explain to Mordecai, I know it's bad for you, but listen to how bad it is for me. This is something that we tend to skip over because we know that eventually Esther is going to do the right thing. But this is how privilege makes us dumb. We're very attuned to our own pain and suffering. It's difficult to empathize with, let alone understand, the risk or threat that somebody else is facing, especially if understanding their pain requires that we do something about it. Esther, in effect, is saying to Mordecai something like, Lord, if it be your will, take this cup from me. She's not as understanding as Jesus is when he prays that prayer. But this is a prayer. We don't want to experience pain, even when we understand the purpose of that risk, the function of that pain, the potential that we have. Esther doesn't have to set aside her pain in the story. All she has to risk is death. So will she? At least initially, she doesn't want to. She does not want to die. Mordecai receives the message, and he tells Hathach to reply to Esther, do not think that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews, for if you keep silent at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter. That's a lot of faith. But you and your father's family will perish. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity, perhaps you have come to privilege for just such a time as this. This is what privilege is for. If I have privilege, it is my responsibility to take extra risk. Then Esther said in reply to Mordecai, go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa. Hold a fast on my behalf. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do. After that, I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. Esther and Mordecai give us an example of how privilege is undone. The sin of privilege is that it allows me to think of myself as separate from other people, which means that privilege, even when faced, even when I admit that I'm exempt from the oppression of my neighbor, even when I admit that I'm complicit in the oppression of my neighbor, even if I admit that I benefit from the oppression of my neighbor, I'm continuing to see them as other than me. Esther and Mordecai, and they have a slight advantage in the story. They're cousins. They're both Jews. They're both under threat. And that advantage makes it a little bit easier for Esther to recognize that you're telling the truth, Mordecai. I do have to take this risk. It's a lose-lose. So she decides that she might as well lose in the direction that carries the most potential for helping everyone, not just herself. They're all stuck in the same system. They all need to be saved from that system of oppression. And so Esther chooses not to stay silent. She can't. And then she asks Mordecai to pray for her. Jesus is asked, but who is my neighbor? And Jesus tells a story about a Samaritan, the story of the Good Samaritan, a story we're familiar with. And one of the things that happens in that story that I think is helpful for us in thinking about privilege is that Jesus doesn't just tell the story of someone who chooses to take a risk. The Good Samaritan puts the man on his own donkey or mule. The Good Samaritan uses money out of his own pocket in order to pay for the housing or shelter of the man who's been beaten and left for dead. The Good Samaritan treats the wounds of the man who's been beaten and left for dead. The Good Samaritan promises after 3 days that he will return. There's a reversal in that story. The reversal is that the Good Samaritan is the other. The Good Samaritan is the oppressed, the one who's persecuted. And Jesus makes the Good Samaritan central to his story. He centers the Good Samaritan in a way that makes the Good Samaritan the Christ figure. Especially that part when he says that he will return on the third day. And if there's any more that the innkeeper has had to put out in order to care for this man, he will cover all of the remaining debts on his return. This story of Esther is also one that I think we're mostly familiar with. The Jews are saved. Haman, the bad guy, is killed. It's actually a pretty violent form of death. And again, depending on the translation you have, it might be that Haman is hanged. It might be that he's actually impaled on a 10 or 15 foot tall pike and then his body left up as an example to others. The Bible has a lot of violence in it. And what happens to Haman is incredibly violent. The story of Jesus unpacks the story of Esther a little bit further. In the Old Testament, we find a focus on what happens to evil people. When God intervenes, justice is served to them in exactly the way that we imagine justice should be served. Going all the way back to the beginning, there's a king named Ai who's hung from a tree. And all through the Old Testament, evil people are hung up or put up. As an example, Haman is just another in this long line of evil people who are finally getting what's come to them. In substitutionary atonement theory, we have a Jesus who dies on the cross in order to make it possible that no one else will have to experience that kind of justice ever again. But substitutionary atonement theory is not the only way of thinking about what Jesus has done. Another way of thinking about what Jesus has done is recapitulation, where Jesus actually puts a new head or a new understanding on these old stories of sacrifice and punishment in the Old Testament. And I think that recapitulation is a key for us understanding what the book of Esther, what God is saying through the book of Esther to us. Under recapitulation, God says to us through Jesus, I'm Haman. I take responsibility. And Jesus challenges us through the book of Esther. Are we willing to do the same? Can we say to Esther, we did this to you? can we say to Mordecai, the loss of your family and of your land, that's on us? Can we say to the eunuch Hegai or the eunuch Hathach or any of the other 10 eunuchs who will never have a family of their own but are expected to take care of everyone else, we will be your family? Can we say to Vashti, you were right to stand up for yourself and to challenge us and to point out our flaws, and instead of changing our behavior, we blamed you for that. And we're not going to do that again. I encourage you to sit with the book of Esther, to read it, to pay attention to what God might be saying to us as the church in a culture of empire. And as we enter open worship, let's remember that Christ is present with us, that Christ knows what we need to hear. Let's let Jesus challenge us this morning.